Good morning, and welcome to Green Zine here at WFVR-LP South Royalton. I'm hoping your roads are smooth. They might get a little muddy here in the next couple days. Going to start off with this version from Elizabeth Cotton.
Going down the road feeling bad, honey, babe, Lord. Going down the road feeling bad, honey, babe, Lord. Going down the road feeling bad. I don't want to be treated this old way. Girl, I love, don't turn her back on me, honey, babe, Lord. Girl, I love, don't turn her back on me, and I don't want to be treated this old way.
Certainly would be a candidate for Song of the Year on One Planet Groove. That song goes way, way back, a version of it going down that old dusty road put out by Woody Guthrie a long time ago. But well, that was Elizabeth Cotton from down North Carolina way, with Going Down the Road Feeling Bad. Drive slow out there. You know, there's a lot of, rough roads and going to be some muddy roads with the weather that's coming in later tonight and into tomorrow. It's supposed to rain all day tomorrow. This is Green Zine, and before I am joined by my regular co-host for more than 11 years, Henry Swayze, we do want to acknowledge the folks that keep this radio environmental magazine going each week, Thursdays at 11 a.m. If you're listening in live time, and I am here live in the studio, Solaflect, the tracking solar company based down in Norwich, Vermont. Bale, building a local economy. Find out more about them at balevt.org. They are heading up a grant program for some micro projects in our area. I've seen flyers all around. You might find out more about that at the website. I believe the deadline for those grants is at the end of August. Also, Tom Wells and his business, Royal Trailworks, based here in Royalton. Daniel Leibowitz, who I hope to be seeing this weekend. Daniel Leibowitz, one of the founding board members of this radio station more than 11 years ago, an avid cyclist and now practicing law down in Washington. And he's coming up. He might be stopping over for our Pedal Power to the People event this weekend. The Upper Pass Beer Company, First Branch Coffee Company, Solar Fest, the White River Land Collaborative planning another event towards the end of August, and a restaurant serving breakfast and lunch in Randolph called Wit and Grit. Now I'm going to bring Henry up. Henry, you're on the air.
Hey, you know, I don't think we should go down the road feeling bad.
Okay.
I think that we just had yesterday was an absolutely glorious day. We were back to low humidity and something you could get out in nature and enjoy. And today is another day like that.
It is.
The fact that we happen to have a tropical
depression
humidity dump coming at us.
That's okay. Debbie's going to be kinder to us than she was a couple of days ago. Debbie's softening up, hopefully. I was told by a listener this morning that Debbie, actually, I think it might have been Jim Rooney who joined me for a bit this morning, that Debbie is heading a little bit west, further west than the original track, and maybe the Adirondacks are going to have the brunt of 4 to 5 inches of rain. Maybe we might get by with just 1.5 to 2 inches here in the Upper White River watershed. So that, we can deal with that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, a little gentle rain is good. When it comes down an inch and a half all in 20 minutes, then we get road washouts.
Okay.
And the here in Burlington, I see the Winooski River running. I walk down along that most days, and yesterday it's still running very brown from the runoff from previous storms.
Yeah,
it's just taking all of that torn loose dirt and dumping into Lake Champlain, where it builds a great flat area at the mouth of the river, the alluvial fan.
Right. Hey, you know, just talking about that rain, and we probably won't talk too much more about it till the end of the show. I've got our closing song. It's a Bob Dylan special as performed by Nico Case, so something to look forward to. But we've got a lot to do between now and the end of the show, Henry. What do we got?
Well, we're gonna focus on today's show about energy conservation, efficient use of energy. And we have our guest is Phil Cellini, who is works with Capstone Community Action. And Capstone Community Action is one of 1,000 across the country, but one of 5 in Vermont that are local action groups originally triggered by the U.S. government. But they actually only get about 10% of their income from the feds, and the rest of it comes from state and donations and grants and various sources. And we'll get into those sources. But the bottom line is that the bottom 60% of the money earners in the country and in Vermont are the people who have the highest percentage of energy in their annual operating cost for their family. And Capstone is focused on that group to try to make their energy bills lower, make living easier and more comfortable. And we're going to dig into what their programs are and, in particular, look at household insulation, because insulation is very dull thing to do. It's not interesting. It's not sexy. It's not new. It isn't shiny. It's none of those things that we're drawn to. But boy, when you get it right, I worked out that if I had a very small room, 8x10 room, I was doing an office in a tractor trailer, and I was trying to figure out how much heat it would take to heat that room. And if you insulate it properly, you can heat that with a 100-watt light bulb and be comfortable in there at 20 below zero outside.
Now, Dale, was I in one of those tractor trailers that you were referencing there, Henry?
Was it? You were.
I was.
Yes, you helped me take one of those apart.
I remember that. Oh, so many stories. Yeah. Well, that's amazing that type of insulation can do that. And yeah, and the geese, I've seen a lot of these Canadian geese, and they have a lot of feathers. Should we go to Bird Note now?
Yes, let's listen to Bird Note. It's all about birds being insulated and what we learn from them.
Yeah, let's go to Bird Note. We'll be right back after that. You're listening to Green Zine here at Royalton Community Radio.
This is Bird Note. Imagine this Canada goose paddling along on a cold winter day. Can you guess how many feathers cover this goose? Hundreds? Thousands? A single Canada goose has between 20 and 25,000 feathers. A smaller bird, like a sparrow or wren, might have 7 to 10,000. Those feathers are uniquely designed to help the bird fly, shed water, or display distinctive markings. A great many feathers are the short, fluffy kind, the down, whose purpose is to insulate the bird from the cold. Birds survive in sub-zero weather by fluffing their feathers, creating layers of air and feathers. Just a fraction of an inch of this insulation can keep a bird's body temperature at 104 degrees, even in freezing weather. People learned years ago how well goose down insulates and began stuffing comforters, sleeping bags, and clothing with it. More recently, we've developed artificial substitutes, but geese and other birds continue to get along just fine with the original material. For BirdNote, I'm Michael Stein. Did you know you can listen to BirdNote in your podcast app? Subscribe to BirdNote Daily and never miss an episode.
Okay, I'm feeling warmer already, Henry. It was a little cool down here this morning.
That's a good subject for a cool day like today. When we get back into the heat waves, we'll wonder why we need to insulate, and then realize it so that we can cool ourselves in our houses too.
Yeah, most definitely. Winter's just around the corner. Get your wood piles ready. Yep.
Yeah. So I attended a meeting last Saturday that was an aha moment for me. I've had a couple of aha moments, and the last one was way back in 2016 when I attended Walter Jena's three-day program on soils, and learned how we can cool the planet by basically just having more green cover, more thriving green material covering the ground. And this Saturday was another one, and this is Martin Freck. Is director of the UN's World Food Program. So he's a heavy hitter. He's from he's based in Berlin, Germany, and he was traveling with his son on a vacation through the United States, and Soil for Climate had interacted with him at some of the COPs meetings, the UN climate change meetings, and they collared onto him and said, hey, come stay with us and talk to people here. And I went, and so he, wearing the hat of the UN Worldwide Food Program, he said, we now produce enough food to feed 9 million people. We just waste a third of it. And that waste is why we don't have enough food to go around. And we also have some people cornering a larger portion of the food supply and some people not getting even a look in at the world's food supply.
Yeah, just to stop you for a second, Henry, is that a correct figure or did you mean that first phrase, we now produce enough food to feed 9 million or 9 billion people?
I'm sorry. It is 9 billion.
Yeah, I figured
it's
it
was the entire planet.
That's right.
The population of the planet.
That's okay. Now you can go. I just want to make sure that's an amazing figure.
Change that M to a B.
Yeah, that's a lot of food
on our.
And then that's a lot of waste as well, though. Wow.
That is an enormous amount of waste. But he went on to a personal note after he got through saying, you know, it's a problem that we need to address, how to get food to the people, not how to grow more of it. But he went on and said that climate change is going to make it tougher and tougher to produce food in the future because we have areas like our Midwest right now where our center pivot irrigation systems are running out of water to do their center pivot thing, and we are we're seeing more desertification of our food producing land, and so climate change he sees as a real big threat to food production in the future. And he went on for a personal note and said that he's thought about this for 15 years or so, and he thinks that the most important thing we can do is not to look for, get buried in the details of all the different solutions, but to generate a ground-up movement, something where the people are saying, hey, climate change is important. Let's fix it. And those people are putting pressure on it puts pressure on who they vote for, picking people who are going to be looking for solutions and working with more local people about local solutions and then state solutions and then governmental solutions around the world. And it'll be that people pressure generating a movement that says, hey, climate change is important. Fix it. And that he feels if we unleash that through social media, we can, in fact, have the biggest impact on moving forward to fix the climate.
So this is basically, this is like a trickle-up process, which we've had a lot of movements like that, and some have gained traction and some not. So we do have movements like the Sunrise Movement, a bunch of young people that are trying to influence. So I guess the two big things that seem to be impediments is we're used to saying, okay, we're going to either vote with our dollars, like I'm not supporting that polluting corporation or buying oil and gas anymore, or something like that, or I'm going to convince our legislators, either locally or nationally or internationally, to start making changes. And that really hasn't gotten as much traction. So I'm wondering, we really need a huge grassroots movement at the local level.
Yes. And he's wanting, ask your friends and neighbors and just people in your community, even the people who are kind of way over on the right-hand side, it's fine. Ask them just how important they think climate is. And that opens up the question or chance for discussion. It gets them thinking about it, facing up to how they actually feel about it. And a large proportion of the U.S. population is said to think that something needs to be done about it. It's just that we haven't galvanized ourselves into demanding that something be done about it. And he went on to say that he watched Greta Thunberg from her sitting on the on Fridays, sitting on the steps to the legislature, saying do something about climate, and she had an enormous impact on doing that. And then he went on to say that now that she has been through college and has had a break and has been studying all the detail, she's now weighing in on all the detail. And he said, that's a mistake. Getting lost in the detail doesn't form that movement. It doesn't. What she did originally had tremendous sympathy, and a movement was formed around it. And it was because it was very simple, very direct, do something.
There you go.
And so that was his take, and I think that really resonated with me, that makes a lot of sense. And I'm not a social media person.
No.
But
neither am I.
I think there are tools that will arrive to be able to do that, and it is social media that is driving a lot of the you know what, people's attitude towards things across the country many of them for out of anger and out of bad things rather than out of positive things.
Right, but, right. So,
social
media, yeah, social media without the fake news. Hey, we're coming up. It is actually 20 minutes past 11. Henry, I'm going to let you go and round up our guest, and you'll be right back soon with somebody from Capstone. And while Henry is making that phone call, a story that we've been covering, because it does appeal to the public, getting out and observing nature without obstructions. Well, this is from the front page of today's Herald. The headline is "Landowner Prevails in Supreme Court. Justices Say Trails Case Can Be Heard." And this is referring to the really long-running case that actually the lawsuit has not been going on for 4 years. I think the lawsuit's probably from the initial one is a little bit over 2 years in the town of Tunbridge about who has the right to do maintenance on a legal trail. There are a lot of towns, probably maybe half or more than half the towns in the state of Vermont that have legal trails. So this has resonance well outside this individual case in Tunbridge. I'll just read you from Judge Eaton, who was leading the Supreme Court and handing this decision down last week. "We conclude that plaintiffs, the landowners, have satisfied the actual case or controversy requirement here. Plaintiffs allege that the town, that would be Tunbridge, has adopted a new policy for maintenance and repair of legal trails. According to plaintiffs, this is the first time in the town's history that it has formally asserted authority to maintain and repair legal trails. The town also established a process for private individuals to apply for and receive permission to exercise the town's authority to maintain and repair legal trails. In sum, the town has taken concrete steps, manifesting its intent to enter onto plaintiffs' property for the purpose of improving the trails." I would add possibly preserving the trails. That's just a little, put that in parentheses. "Assuming, as we must, for purposes of a motion to dismiss, these allegations are true. They demonstrate a sufficiently concrete threat of physical invasion and interference with plaintiffs' asserted right to control who enters or alters their property." There's a whole lot of backstory to that, but I'll just leave it there. If you want to get the full story, at least from Darren Marcy, who wrote that for the Herald, it's in today's edition. Well, let's go back and see if Henry's been able to connect with our guest. Are you there, Henry? He is not there yet, but I think he's going to be pretty soon. Let me give you a little preview of some other stories we may be covering after we talk with our guest. One is a story about the wildfires. I just heard from someone today. They have a relative that lives in Oregon, and there was a small wildfire there. There are some large ones in Washington State and Oregon that are still burning, but one got started, and fortunately it was put out, and it only ended up 4 miles away from where these relatives of a friend of mine were living. Also, from the Climate Forward page of the New York Times, an interesting story on groundwater, a national story on groundwater, and arguing that the country needs to establish a national groundwater policy. Otherwise, there are those who say, well, we could build huge pipelines that could carry groundwater, excess water from, let's say, Mississippi to the Midwest or maybe out to Tucson, Arizona. Which is a place that I think economically and just ethically we don't really want to go. And towards the end of the show, we may cover where in the United States, as far as EV drivers go, get the best deal. In other words, the electricity rates in the state that you're using the charging, how that affects your cost of driving your vehicle. Now let's see if we've got Henry. Henry, are you there on the line?
Yes, I am, and I have Phil Cellini from Capstone on the line with me. Welcome to Green Team, Phil.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, glad to have you with us, Phil.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here.
So, Phil, I think maybe we ought to start by just asking what all Capstone Community Agency does, kind of what all laundry list of all the different things they got their fingers in, and then we'll come over and focus on the foundational thing, which is that, you know, we have some of the oldest housing stock in the nation, and 30% of our carbon emissions come from those houses, and what we can do about improving our quality of life and doing something about making the housing stock friendlier. Okay.
Certainly. So Capstone Community Action. So Capstone Community Action has a number of different programs ranging from helping people just sort of make ends meet, to building stronger families, and of course, helping keeping people warm in their homes, and opening the doors to economic opportunity for them. You know, as far as making ends meet, we have things like food and nutrition programs, a food shelf. We have home heating and utility assistance to help people with heating bills. We have housing counseling and homeless prevention services. As far as building stronger families, we have our Head Start and Early Head Start programs, which is early childhood education. We have the Child Care Food Program to make sure they're fed and have nutritious food for children, especially while they're in daycare centers. We have what's called the Family Literacy Center, which is part of the Head Start program. It's for pregnant and parenting high school students. Make sure they have some support and get their degrees, get their GED, get their diploma, as well as sort of that group and support. And of course, with weatherization, there's the, we weatherize up to, Capstone weatherizes about 1,000 homes every year, both in what we call 3E thermal, which is multifamily, and with our low-income weatherization assistance program. Part of that is we do energy education while we're in the homes, as far as how they use the home and to make it, to conserve energy. And I skipped over our Community Economic Development Department, where we have a number of different programs to help people be a little bit more independent. One that I personally find pretty exciting is called Community Kitchen Academy, where we bring students in for a couple months, and they work in a commercial kitchen and under a chef, and get a certification that allows them to come out of that and work in kitchens. So it's taking people with no experience and giving them some real skills. In the meantime, they're preparing food for the food shelf, and they do some really great work. We have micro business development, where we have a number of workshops where we support entrepreneurs to start building, businesses, or to develop their businesses. You know, everything from how they market, how they build a business plan, how they track their expenses. We have savings and credit programs to help people learn how to create home budgets and individual budgets, and build toward a savings goal. One more. Can't forget the tax preparation program, where we help people do taxes every year. And we have some transportation programs, where one program called Mileage Smart, we help people buy energy efficient vehicles, the electric vehicles, people that qualify for the program. And another one that actually just spun off from us that we helped start is Community Rides Vermont, where they provide, I'll call it a taxi-like service for under several grants to help people in the General Barrie area get to and from appointments, to and from work. We help kids get to school, help low-eligible people get to doctor's appointments, social engagements, and those are done with EVs.
Gotcha. So that's
sort of a quick laundry list of what we do.
That is a very big laundry list.
Yeah.
So I have put a link up in our show links at the bottom of the station website, and under that Green Zine link, there is a link to capstonevermont.org about us that gives you that laundry list that you can delve into and get more information and make contact with people that way. So
great.
That's already extant.
I'm sure web servers are being overwhelmed as we speak then.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
So let's switch over to and focus on making our old housing stock act more like the ultra efficient houses that we would love to be in. Can you give us an overview? I've been interested in this for a number of years, and you people have basically had all your money scooped up, and I understand that you have some new monies that are available that you actually can take on some additional projects that you had to wait quite a while for in the past.
So the weatherization programs around the state, and down in your area, of course, it's, you know, Capstone is in there. I think there's some folks from some of your territories probably reaches into the NITO, which is another sister agency, and SAVCA as well. So depending on, because you're sort of in the corner of where the three agencies sort of come together. And of course, Capstone, I don't want to forget about us. But yes, and so the agencies have gotten additional funding over the last several years. It's helped with our backlog. Some of the other agencies are struggling a bit with staffing to get the right people in. That's always an issue. But yeah, we're able to do more units and help more families be weatherized.
And so can you then jump over and say what the income levels are that you are focused on and can give the most help to? And then what is the advantage for people? Because I think people think of you as so much of your work is aimed on people who are homeless and, you know, or just got flooded or whatever.
Yes.
And to me, you have a much bigger focus than that.
Certainly. So to start with, you know, who can we serve as far as income goes? I'm going to give you two answers to that because that's what I like to do. In general, we can serve people, say a family of four with a household income of, depending on which county, we'll just say it's up to $84,300 if you're in Washington County. Down in your area, it's probably more like $81,850, which is a percent of some formulas that our funders have. So a family of four with income of, you know, around, you know, $82,000 to $84,000.
And I quoted that might be about 60% of the population. Am I right about that?
Well, of the pop, I believe that's 85% of median. The 60%, I'm glad you brought that up. There's our funding is layered. It comes from different funding sources, and different funders have different requirements. We're getting a lot of our funding currently is limited to that. It's actually at 200% of federal poverty, which is a lot lower than the numbers I just read you.
Yes.
So for a family of four, we're talking $62,400. So that pot of money, we have more funds to help more families. So between that 62 and say that 87, or what is 84,300, there's less funding for that, which is different than the way it's been in the past.
Yeah. So for someone in the upper, someone who's between that's between the 60s and the 80,000 in income, might have a longer queue to wait in than
That's correct. Yeah. That's correct. Which, from one perspective, I'm really happy to help the lower income folks. You know, the fees, presumably there's a higher need there. And certainly when you look at their energy burden, which is the cost of all their energy divided by their income, they're the ones that really sort of need attention first.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up that energy burden term, because we've discussed this before a couple of years ago when that I became more familiar with that term. And I know that Orange County is literally a couple miles away. We broadcast from Windsor County, but I remember reading that Orange County has one of the highest energy burdens of any county in Vermont. And probably a lot of the folks over there that have that high energy burden are in that lower, that 62,000 household. So I guess my follow-on question from there, not to deviate too much, is, you said staffing is getting the right people in the right places, but that outreach effort to let those people know who are eligible for these funds in a very respectful way, how do you reach out to them and target where those houses are that really need that work?
Yeah, that's really important. So how do we reach out to them? A couple of ways. Certainly, we're embedded within a community action agency. And that's the target. That's the population we serve as a CAP agency. So that's one way. So when people come in for services, but again, that only captures the folks that come in and seek our help. We also reach out to mailing lists for people to get fuel assistance. So the state shares that list with us, it's a requirement of receiving fuel assistance to consider weatherization. So we mail out to all the recipients. We'd send out about 3,000 within our service area, which is Lamoille, Orange, Washington County, and a few other towns around the edges, like down toward your way. We talk on the radio when they let us.
Okay, well, we're glad we let you. Henry?
Yes, so give people a sense when we come to buttoning up a house, just how much can happen. How do you heft whether you should bother thinking about this as a renter or a homeowner? What size energy bill do you have to have, or how bad do you have to feel about burning fossil fuels instead of using heat pumps or whatever?
Good question. We find that almost any house can use improvements. Maybe not yours, but most any house has
mine definitely needs improvements.
Actually, our approach is we come in into the house and we run some tests on the house to see what's needed. And probably the biggest test is the, outside of a physical inspection, is a blower door test, where we actually can pressurize a house, blow it up like a balloon, and see how much, with some really fine gauges, seeing how much air is leaking out. So it's called a blower door test. And based on that, that tells us the number of air exchanges in the house and tells us how much work needs to be done and to that home.
So that's interesting. That's not really about insulation. That's about making sure that you haven't got the windows in the basement and the windows in the attic open at the same time.
Well, that's one part of it, but it's an interesting fact that surprised me, because I should add, I'm not a building scientist. I work next to many of them. Several years ago, we handed out basic beach balls the size of a basketball. And the message on it said, so picture a beach ball, picture the size of a basketball, hold it up to your house, your outside wall, and if you add up all the cracks in your house through the roof, wire penetrations, pipes, because of shifting in plaster, you add up all that space, it's a hole the size of a basketball.
Ooh. That's a big hole.
So if you picture... has a bigger hole than that.
Yeah, I agree.
So if you picture that basketball just being passed out of your house all day and night, that's how much air you're losing and heat you're losing out to the environment. Now, certainly, as you insinuated earlier, depends on the rate of air escaping depends on a lot of different factors that we'd probably bore everybody, but you and I on talking about, but it's, you know, the air pressure in the house, the flow of air, the chimney effect of air coming in the bottom, going out the top, can affect the difference in temperatures between top and bottom, can affect the amount of airflow. So our first step is to measure that and then understand what the opportunity is, and that's why we blow up the house, or pressurize the house with a blower door. So after the end, that's done by an energy auditor who has a lot of experience and training in building science and how houses work. They create a work scope and then send our crews out to do the work, and you know they use different techniques. Everything from air sealing to stop those cracks. They'll look at the amount of insulation to keep the heat into the building. And then when they're done, they're also very concerned about make sure there is some air exchanges. So we tighten it up as much as we can, and then we create some ventilation. That seems a little counterintuitive. But you're putting the ventilation where you need it, and you're giving it the amount of ventilation that it needs.
Right, just a measured amount of ventilation.
It's a measured amount, and because you don't want to keep too much humidity in the house, that can create issues. And, of course, you and I like to have a little fresh oxygen in the room as well to live.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So what kind of change in fuel bill does this result in a typical
leaky house
workover?
Yeah.
In a typical home that we see, we'll see it's not uncommon to see 35%. 30%. I've seen as high as 50%. That's a reduction in fuel use. So 30 to 35% would be fairly typical.
Right.
So and every year in, year out for the next 21.7 years is the average life of the measures. When you have statistics, you got to quote them, right?
That's great. So, and what's the cost of doing that? Who pays what, and how much out of, how much does the homeowner have to pay, and where do they get that money, assuming that they are don't have it in their checking account?
So for our clients, the cost to them is to let us into their house to do the work. There is no cost. Our grants cover it. 100%.
That's the message. That's the message I want to get through to people who might not be might not realize the opportunities that are out there.
Yes,
just wow.
It's absolutely no cost, and we can come out once every 15 years. So if you've never had weatherization done at your house and you're thinking, well, I don't know if I really need it, well, just give us a call anyhow. We'll come down and we'll take a look and we'll let you know. It's no cost to you. We're happy to do it. We're finding that oftentimes there are savings. You know, whether you heat by wood or by fuel oil, there's often work that we can do to make your house more energy efficient, comfortable, and improve the health of your home.
Yeah, and to extend that a little further, I just have one more question before we let you go, and that is when the audit is being done, or maybe when Capstone comes in, just to kind of go to the next level, like, hey, we've done the blower door tests, we think we can reduce your fuel bill prices, whether it's wood, oil, natural gas, by 30, potentially 40%. Is there also advice or recommendations and possibly funding either from Capstone or another agency like Efficiency Vermont to move that homeowner eventually away from burning fossil fuels? And actually, if they live in a kind of home where it looks like a heat pump could really do them some good and be affordable, or maybe be covered by another grant, is that something that's kind of in the electric pipeline?
It is, and I actually I didn't mention it because funding for that's getting a little tight right now.
Yeah,
we've put in over the last number of years quite a few heat pumps into homes to help with fuel switching, so people can use less fuel oil and rely on heat pumps, electric to heat their home. We actually like to have people to have two sources of heat, because when you are in Vermont and it's 10 below zero, heat pumps will work, but they're probably not the most efficient.
Yes.
And it doesn't hurt to have a little boost from another source, the electrification is in that fuel switching has been very important, because it certainly helps us stop using some of the fossil fuels.
And if people want to become engaged with you, what's the best way for them to move ahead on that?
A couple ways. They can give us a phone call, 1-877-919-2299. That's 877-919-2299. And, ask one of the people that answers the phone your questions, and they'll be happy to get an application out to you.
Mm-hmm. All right. We'll put that on our links page.
Great. And there's a quick app online as well. You've already linked to it from the website.
Right. I know I personally attempted to fill that out, and I didn't have – it gave me a PDF form to fill out, and my PDF is a reader-only, so it wasn't lickety-split. But it's certainly a way of that many people may find they already have the tools to do. And if you don't, we'll have that phone number up there as well.
Yeah, and call us, and we'll be happy to mail you an application. Or if you're near one of our offices, and we have offices I think probably the nearest one there is in Randolph, where on Prince Street, where we they'll be glad to hand an application to you.
Right. All right. And do the people, if you go to the office in Randolph, because that is our probably the closest office to most of our listeners, if they went to that office, is it basically getting paperwork done, or is it would there actually be someone knowledgeable about the programs and a way of getting a little bit of heft for what made sense for them to do?
Yeah, so if you go to the Randolph office, that's one of our, I'll call it an outpost. They're really not, all of our weatherization is done out of the offices in Barrie.
Yeah.
They wouldn't be the ideal people to talk to. I'm sure they would certainly try to help you. They're very helpful folk. But if you had a lot of real detailed questions, I would call that 800 number, that 877 number, and speak to one of our people in the weatherization department.
Super. All right. Thank you so much, Phil, for joining us and letting us know how much is potentially can happen here. I would love to see Vermont housing stock get a heck of a lot cleaner, because it'll do just as much as cheap electric cars will do for turning the tide on climate change.
Yeah.
Yeah, agreed. Thanks. Thank you very much for having me on.
Yeah, thank you.
Really
thank you,
it.
Phil. We'll talk to you again in the future. Right.
Okay.
Right.
Look forward
yep.
to it.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye now.
All right, Henry, staying on the theme of lowering fossil fuel use, but also saving money. I'm looking at a New York Times article that came out. Actually, this is from Green Car Reports. Henry and I collect information from many, many sources and try to pass along useful things to our listeners. And this story written just a few days ago by Stephen Edelstein, where in the U.S. do EVs save the most money in fuel versus gasoline? So, Henry, I'm going to put you on the spot. Just pick a region, northwest, northeast, southwest, southeast, midwest. Where do you think the biggest savings are currently in the country?
Texas.
No. Texas is the same as Vermont. First of all, every state in the country is still cheaper in monies spent per mile, whether you're buying gasoline, diesel, or whether you're using an EV. EVs are lower in every state, but the spot that is the cheapest is in the Pacific Northwest, Oregon and Washington State.
Hydropower.
And the darkest one there actually is Idaho, and that is saving about 16 cents per mile over the cost of gasoline. Now, part of this is driven by the type of vehicles, particularly regular combustion vehicles, that are being driven in the area. So, for instance, up there in the Pacific Northwest, much like here, a lot of pickup trucks, larger vehicles that are burning a lot of gas, but also cheaper electricity prices in those states. So some states we wouldn't think would be very green as far as that difference in costs, like Montana and Wyoming, are also less expensive to drive an EV in those states. They have low utility costs. So that plays a major role. The sort of crossover line between the cheaper cost of electricity as opposed to fossil fuels has drawn closer. About 5 years ago, it was a 3-to-1 ratio. In other words, 1/3 the cost to power your car over 100 miles than it would if you were buying gas. Now it's not quite even, but it's probably a little bit closer to 60-40 rather than the 2/3. So I just thought I would pass that along. You know, check out your utilities if you're really cost conscious in the long run as far as maintenance and other factors that are not in this graph that I'm looking at. that plays a whole different role. And one other quick thing on EVs, if you're out buying one of the questions you want to ask, particularly if you're interested in the rate of high-speed charging that you can get, there's a pretty big range between a vehicle that's capable of taking a high-speed charge in a low amount of time, and it goes up from there. So just some more homework for you to check out. Back to you, Henry.
So that a high-speed charging is particularly important if you plan to be on a road trip. You're going to go way far away from home, and you're going to have to fill up one as you go along.
That's right. If you were trying to compare cars and you knew that the primary user, you were a long-distance driver, you probably would want to look at a vehicle that can accept a high-speed charger faster than most of the vehicles that are on the market right now. Yep.
And the reason I chose Texas, and it's going to happen across the country, even though I was wrong, is that Texas will do a time-of-day charging. So they will give you a lower rate, and they'll give you an even better rate if you are willing to not charge at certain peak times.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a trend that will happen, that all the utilities will be forced into doing as time goes on. And so home charging, if you are paying 16 cents a kilowatt for your electricity for the home in general, you may be able to charge at something like 8 cents a kilowatt if you're charging at selected times.
Yeah, interesting. And I wonder if Texas is kind of in the lead on that based on their fragile grid setup. They kind of have their own grid in Texas. They're not connected, and they've had some serious issues. So driving people to use power at really low times, probably part of trying to solve or at least improve the problems that they've had there with their grid.
Yeah, it's a wide open market. The utility companies do long-term contracts in Vermont to level out their cost of electricity. In Texas, there isn't the same degree of long-term contracts, and their electricity is being purchased in 15-minute blocks off the internet.
Wow.
Or off the spot market, and so the price can go 1,000 times higher for a block 3 hours later in the day.
Wow. That's pretty daunting.
Volatile.
Volatile indeed. Hey, I'm just going to squeeze in. Yes, you do hear a little bit of Bob Dylan's Buckets of Rain. We're hoping we're not going to get too many buckets as Debbie passes by, mostly to the west of us, starting this evening around 8 or 9 o'clock and continuing with rain all through the day tomorrow and ending on early Saturday morning. Green Zine has been brought to you this week on WFER-LP South Royalton, Royalton Community Radio, by the following generous folks. The White River Land Collaborative having another Sunday Burger Night and Art event at the end of the month in the town of Tunbridge. Wit and Grit, Solar Fest, First Branch Coffee Company, the Upper Pass, Upper Pass Beer Company, Daniel Leibowitz, who we hope to see out riding with us for the 3P11 this weekend, goes through three towns, Royal Trail Works, Bale, and Solaflect. Henry, we've got about a minute and a half to go. If you have any links or you want to let people know about.
Well, I just want to reemphasize, ask yourself on a scale of 1 to 10, how important do you think climate change is? We'd love to hear answers from you as to what your score is. What's the best way for people to drop that back to us?
Yeah, well, they can info@royaltonradio.org. That is a universal email address that arrives here at the station. I will see that, and we can include that. Once again, just info@royaltonradio.org. And that reminds me, in the mail, I got a scorecard for our legislators from the Vermont Conservation Voters Organization. I'll bring that with me next week. Of course, we've got primary next week, so there's a way to exercise the franchise. The primary in Vermont is this coming Tuesday at your local town or municipal building. So get out and vote.
Vote. Yep. Vote.
vote. That's a very good way to get people doing what you want to see done.
Yeah, it is. All right, thanks for joining us on Green Zine. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up next on Royalton Community Radio. See you next week, Henry.
Bye-bye.